I'm going to let you listen to the, relax. I'm going to let you listen to the episode. It's not a problem. Okay. It's here. It's ready. It's here for you. I just have a couple of updates that I wanted to punch in before we get started. First of all, if you haven't noticed, Border Boss and Friends is on island time. We're both very busy. Mike's super busy. I'm super busy. There's tons of Cyber Monday deals we got to keep up with. But we'll be back. Week, 2 weeks, we'll definitely be back. But in the meantime, I wanted to draw your attention to an important update. If you remember, a couple months ago, we uploaded a video episode where we offered some thoughts on a 1991 slice of life video of some teens working at a Taco Bell at a mall in the middle of nowhere. And the original uploader, Steve A., has left a comment on the video. And he's very reasonable, given the, I'm going to say, potentially creepy circumstance of finding two strangers talking about his real actual life. And he addresses the racial slur at the end of the video. So I'm going to let you be the judge. The video is on borderboss.rip. You'll probably have to click through to see the comments. I don't know. You know, I'm not going to tell you how to use your computer. But anyway, check it out. When you get a minute, don't rush out. Don't drop what you're doing. But when you get a minute, check it out, read the comment, and, you know, enjoy a little extended universe action from Border Boss and Friends. Anyway, here's episode 35.
I don't tell you long ago. 400 and 600 shining platters of meals missed and bills unpaid. But a spider makes his home there. But I guess that's good for something. It's not a hobby of mine anymore. My hobby is spinning these holes. No joy, no worms, no boat. My job is just filling these holes. No check, no cake, no good watch.
Okay, so every 2 weeks, Border Boss, the Taco Bell podcast, becomes a different podcast called All Holes Filled, where two people who did not check boxes when they were young and did not study and did not try to be completionists try and change that. You know, so 150 episodes in, we're going to be the guys you want to call on Music Trivia Night. We're going to be the Jeff Speakman perfect weapon of music trivia. We're going to have filled all the holes. We're going to know everything about every seminal, pivotal, important album of the last 50 years at least. So the idea of this is that, you know, we pick albums that I think are undebatably important. Like they have to be, you know, they have to kind of like meet a standard. They should be important to a genre or a movement or just, you know, whatever. They should be like kind of a pivotal album of something or other, or at least important album. And we missed it. We missed it the first time around, or we didn't appreciate it, or, you know, we bought it and then flung it at the wall because it was so bad. And we're going to try again now because we're enlightened patrician class bodhisattvas who are open-minded. We pick one from a general category, which is, you know, people of our ilk could consider it important, whatever that means. You know, it could be anything from a Led Zeppelin album we missed, which is not me because I've listened to every Led Zeppelin album. Or, you know, it could be
Miles Davis.
Could be Miles Davis. Could be, yeah, anything from the 1820s to the 2040s. But if it's considered, you know, essential listening to a modern adult, we're going to grab that. And then we pick another one that is also specific. Specific to us means, to me, I think it means that it's in a genre that we sort of hold dear and we should have known this one.
Yeah.
So like a hardcore album or a metal album or a hip hop album, that it's something we probably should have had a handle on when we were 16 and we forgot. We completely forgot. But all these definitions are flexible. We just pick a couple albums that we want to listen to because I'm just trying to clear out some cobwebs. See, I'm trying to, like, yeah, you know, I want to, cause I'm jealous. I'm frankly jealous of people that are good at this stuff. And frankly, I'm jealous of people that can name every player on an album, the label that it was on, you know, the circumstances it was recorded under, that can draw parallels, that can tell me all about every David Bowie recording session or whatever. I'm jealous of that. I don't think I'll ever get there, but I want to be able to fake it. I want to be able to say, oh yeah, that album. Oh yeah, that fucking album. I know that album. So this week, we're starting out with me. My personal pick was Trapped Under Ice, Secrets of the World. Mike, were you familiar with this album prior?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was.
So, you know, in the years this came out, were we still in a band? Were we still doing Eviction at this time?
No, this was like 2000. This is pretty late. I think it might have been 2010. Let me look it up.
2009.
2009, there we go. Yeah.
Reaper Records. So we weren't in a band anymore, but a lot of our ex-band members were still in bands, and we had a message board with other hardcore dudes. And was this part of the genre that we were calling stepdad hardcore?
This was the progenitor. Is that the word for it? The progenitor of stepdad hardcore, for sure, yes.
This is the sun source of what we called stepdad or work boots hardcore.
Yes.
More or less because it was really like meat and potatoes hardcore where they bitched about normal stuff.
and the band members had an affinity for wearing clothes that a divorced dad would wear or a stepdad would wear.
Yeah, they would show up in the actual slightly oversized Walmart jeans, the Arizona
flannels,
jeans.
Yeah.
The flannels.
and the Carhartts, yeah.
Like legitimate work boots that you're actually trying to work in. Yeah. So 2009 on Reaper Records, this is a band from, are they from Baltimore? Or are they just
Baltimore, Duck Motherfucker. Yes,
Duck
Baltimore.
Motherfucker, Ball. Yeah. Trapped Under Ice, named, I assume, after a Metallica song, but you can never tell.
Yeah.
These motherfuckers, the name, like that's Trapped Under Ice, that's a Metallica song. Do they know? I don't know. I don't know if they know. So this band has a singer whose name is Justice. I don't know if that's his given name. It's a cool name. And he kind of pioneered a style that has taken off quite a bit since this album. It's where he just kind of shouts like panic, like natural sounding, like he's in a panic, like he's got a problem and he needs to get it off his chest. And there's no studying, there's no practice. He's not doing, you know, a metalcore sort of rehearsed grunt or growl, or he's not doing a dead guy thing. He's not doing an integrity thing. He's just shouting as though someone is stepping on his toe. Not in a bad way. Like I'm kidding around, but it's fine. Like what he does is fine. And he does it to sort of, I would say, a hip hop cadence, like a dated hip hop cadence. Like he kind of lands, like it's got a swing to it. Like down, something like that. Occasionally he dips into some alternate voices and they are not cool.
I've never read the liner notes. I don't know if that's him or other guys in the band. I'm hoping there are other guys in the band because if he's doing those voices, that's not cool. You're right.
if it's somebody else and they're doing backups, that's cool. That's fine.
Yeah.
But if it's, they don't need to, because what he does covers it. You know, like because he's so singular, it should just be him. I think other people trying to horn in on what he's doing, they don't do it. They don't do justice. But if it is him, boy, is it bad. Because every now and then he dips into this kind of like, that part is sad. They have a song where the refrain of the song is T-U-I till I die. That seems unearned to me. Sometimes I like that. Like Suicidal Tendencies used to do that a lot. They had like a lot of songs where they would talk about, you know, ST, swear your, like pledge your allegiance to ST and stuff like that. And I kind of liked it when I was a kid. And like for some reason, I know that they had a 7-inch out before this that's Still Cold or Stay Cold, and it was a big deal. So maybe by this time they were enough of a swinging dick to have a song called T.U.I. Till I Die. But I don't know. I don't think so. So the thing about this, we talked about this a little bit separately, partially because we have friends who are in Trapped Under Ice influenced bands.
Yes.
So it's been sort of a background topic of our lives for a while now. But I think, one of the things we don't do, at least I don't do on All Holes Filled, is a bunch of research. So I don't know all of what was going on around this band. I don't know what led to Trapped Under Ice. I don't know if there's a scene or if there's like a precursor to this. But around this time and a little bit before this, there was this whole Entombed Core thing where all of a sudden guitars in hardcore and metalcore got really heavy. They got really like produced and heavy, and these guys kind of have the splash of that. Their guitar sounds like a synthesizer. Like it never stops ringing out. When the guy hits a note, it goes and it stays there until he doesn't want to play that note anymore. It's really dense. It's really smooth. If you have any guitar buddies, sometimes they talk about the HM2 sound. This doesn't exactly have it, but it's kind of in that ballpark. That means that, like, you know, they use an HM2 pedal to get this really saturated, wide sounding, heavy guitar sound, and it will sustain forever just like this. But you know, you could play most of this album with one finger on your left hand. I think that they wanted that. I don't think I'm not I don't think they don't know how to play guitar. It's very clean. It's very accurate. It's like really properly done. It's this is like totally adequate version of whatever this is. And it's got tons of energy. Like this definitely has plenty of energy. This isn't, I bet I would like this live. You know, like have you ever seen these guys live?
Man, I honestly cannot remember. If I did, I probably didn't pay attention because I mean, I was old. I was over 30 or close to, I was around 30. I did not watch bands. I was just getting drunk probably.
they played a couple fests that I was at and I think I might have, you know, like looked in that room or whatever and seen it, but that's not really my thing. So I didn't really check it out, but like I don't really like Sick of It All, but I like to see Sick of It All. You know, there's a band doesn't have to meet my musical standards for me to enjoy it live. And I bet these guys deliver it live. I'm sure of it. But you know, that guitar sound. Sorry to dwell on this for people who don't care about guitars, but that's kind of where this thing falls apart for me is that it's so plain. Like the way, what they're doing on the instruments and with the music is so plain. Like listen to, Turnstile. You know, they're kind of like these days, they're sort of like in a contemporary or whatever.
They were born out of Trapped Under Ice, which is
they're
crazy.
A follower, right. Yeah. So they're a follower, but the way that
it's members of Trapped Under Ice.
Oh, is it?
I at this point, I don't know. It's probably just one guy from Trapped Under Ice, but they have like a connection, yeah.
Well, he bought a new amp. He bought a new amp and a new guitar and a new pedal. And, you know, when you hear someone play the Turnstile way, you can sort of hear the strings and you can hear the, you know, the chord. And that's the color. That's all you get. Like with this kind of music, you only get that information. So if you don't get even, if you do the Trapped Under Ice thing, you're missing basically all the musical information entirely. All you get is a screaming guy and one note and the drums. And, that is kind of where this whole thing sort of like, I don't dislike this album. Like when I played it, I was like, yeah, this is okay. Like this is background music is adequate. Wasn't really lighting me up because I'm not really like, I want more detail and I want more bells and whistles. They don't really give it to you until sometime around the midpoint. I don't know what happened, but then there's like this showcase. They have this song called The Vortex and I Hand in the middle of the album. And all of a sudden the guitarist grows four new fingers and starts playing all the other notes on this guitar. And they start doing all these dynamics and there's just like bass parts and there's all this stuff happens. And on top of that, the album is called Secrets of the World, so I was expecting some mystical lyrics. I was expecting some, like, you know, Aleister Crowley sex magic. didn't get it until all of a sudden, halfway through the album, this song, I think it's I Hand, I don't know, one of these songs, all of a sudden is all crazy, weird, mystical lyrics. Until this, it's just been lyrics that are just complaining. Like, the world sucks, I'm beaten down, I have to work all day, it sucks, whatever. Then all of a sudden this song is all about, you know, I don't know, serpents and wizards or something like that. It gets real bizarre. And like, I like that. It only lasts a couple songs and then it goes immediately away and goes right back to what was at the beginning of the album. All of which is basically fine, but it's not for me. I can't put my finger on what it is, but there's something about this genre that's kind of hollow.
Would you have liked this when you were 16 years old?
I don't know. I really don't. Probably because it's really heavy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like really good sounding and heavy and thick and he screams, you know, the guy yells authentically and I kind of like that stuff. So if I heard it when I was 16, I probably would have heard the good in it. I don't know if I would.
So I just want to correct myself. Brandon from Turnstile, who's the singer of Turnstile, was in Trapped Under Ice. I don't know what the fuck he did in Trapped Under Ice. So
yeah,
now he's a singer though. And he's, that man is much more famous than Trapped Under Ice, so I guess he made the right move. I was familiar with this album. This album is basically let's start with a prologue. Is prologue the one before?
Yeah.
Prologue. Yeah. So about when I was 21, 22 years old, I think, around that age is when the book and later on the documentary American Hardcore came out. Yeah. This was a pretty well-known book that kind of covered the birth and early beginnings of American hardcore. And it's a great book, except you get to the last chapter and it's like all of these old men, these old blowhards saying, oh, hardcore died in like 1986 and stuff like that. Just like this real bitter shit. Like the whole last chapter is a super bitter shit. And the documentary is even more bitter shit. So after I read the book and saw the documentary, I was like, I never want to grow up to be this person in hardcore. Like, I never want to be the person that's like, back in my day and blah, blah, blah. Because that became a lot more prominent when me and Scott were of prime hardcore age, basically. It was just like a lot of people saying, oh, you know, that's not as good as fucking some old band. There's no Bad Brains. And it's just like, who fucking cares, man? Hardcore should be youth culture. If you're over the age of like 26, I don't think your opinion should matter in anymore in hardcore. That doesn't mean you shouldn't listen, but you know, I don't think what you say goes anymore because you're too old.
Right.
And that's why, not to get into a diatribe, but that's why I think all these bands that just do reunion shows into their 50s need to let kids take over. And, it's a youth movement. It's not for you're like a 45-year-old man to live out his dreams because he doesn't have a very good job in real life. Just, you know, just fucking let the kids do it, man. And, you know,
especially because cool. You have to sing those lyrics, man. You wrote those lyrics when you were 19.
That's what's so bad about it. It's so embarrassing. I mean, you know, I know we have a lot of listeners that are probably in their 40s and probably in bands, so I don't want, no disrespect to you. I'm not saying you can't play shows, but when you see like fests and like the first five bands on the show or the first five headlining bands are like all bands that I saw when I was 16, that's kind of a problem, I think. But that's just how I personally feel. But anyways, what I'm getting to is when I was, you know, very young, when I was 16 years old, that was when Madball came out, and I was like, this fucking album is amazing. It was on Roadrunner Records, which is a big record label I liked a lot. It was like ultra produced compared to any other kind of New York hardcore at the time.
Yeah.
It was just like, it was insane. His vocals on that are just an amazing record. I'm talking about Set It Off, just in case you guys don't know. And I'm like, to this day, there's very few New York or Tough Guy hardcore albums that I think even touch that album. And so that genre was popular for a while, kind of died out. And a few years after it died out, a band called No Warning came out, which were a bunch of Canadian boys. One of them is now in Fucked Up. He's the one. He's also related to the girl who was in The Wizard that I forget her real name.
Right.
But anyways, he was in a band called Fucked Up, and it was basically
Jenny Lewis.
Yeah, it's like it's her brother.
Parker Lewis.
Yeah. Parker Lewis from No Warning and Fucked Up. Yes. No Warning was kind of just like a Madball worship band. And then it kind of came back. And I was like, this is fucking cool, man. These kids, they're not like, you know, they're not huge goons. These are just some fucking suburban kids. I mean, they pretended they were huge goons, but they were like tiny, tiny boys, you know? They weren't like really tough or anything. But I was like, this is cool. It's like bringing it back. And I was into it because I was of the age. And then like 5-6 years later is when Trapped Under Ice kind of blew up. Yeah. And I think I was just like, this is one of the first records I heard that I was like, I'm getting too old for this shit. And so it was like a real miserable time. But I kind of like wrote it off because I kind of hated it because I was just like, man, this is like the fucking third iteration of this. And if you're counting like Revelation Record stuff, like even before Madball, it's kind of like the fourth iteration. So it was just kind of like, this is just like, but you know, kids were fucking loving it. And it was like, it was almost like overnight, there was like 300 bands that sounded like Trapped Under Ice. And so I kind of just, you know, I listened to it, and I just kind of hated on it. So I never got to like really, you know, listen to it without bias until this time. And I will say I still have a lot of the same problems with it. It's like Scott said, the guitars are just, everything on this is like way too clean and plain. It's like, it's just like filtered even more than No Warning was. Because No Warning was like a more cleaner, tighter version. And this is even like getting to the point where it's just like
clinical.
It's very clinical. There's no, they don't even really have one song on here that's like this standout. Like, you know, even if Madball, if you don't like Madball, you probably still know Set It Off.
Right.
If you know you're that age, if you didn't like them back then, you still know that song because it's a good song. But this is just like, you know, it doesn't have anything like that. I don't know what kids like grasped onto to make them the band that everybody worshipped. I think it was just kind of right place, right time. They were doing more of a harder edged hardcore sound. And people were thirsty for it again, so it kind of blew up. The one thing I don't like, he does have good vocals overall. He kind of fits a lot, way too many words into lines, and
right.
I don't know if that ever progressed beyond that, where it was kind of he held off on that. But the one thing I don't like is these vocals are super punched in. Basically, he's saying a line, And his second line after that fades in.
Right.
While his first right, line
like
is fading
over,
out.
You let it overlap
yeah.
kind of like
yeah. yeah. And I hate that. And you know, it was okay. Like, if he just did it, I'd be fine with it. I'd be like, okay, that's kind of like, it's kind of like VOD, Vision of Disorder. They had that guy sang, he sang real bad, and he would always gasp air in between lines. And mm-hmm. it was kind of like, became right. like his twitch. He'd be like, between songs, or, you know, James Hetfield's, yeah, at the end of
John Tardy, all of his, like,
yeah. It's fine when one person does it, but, you know, all these bands, they did it too. That, like, you would hear these clean recordings with these punched in vocals, and it's just like, you don't need to do it just because this fucking guy did it.
Right.
And it's just like, it's just so crazy to me that this record spawned just a bunch of bands that were like, we want to sound ultra clean, but we want to play like hard edged hardcore. Very plain, very, it's kind of just like, you know, it's almost kind of like the tough guy version of like Poison the Well's metalcore, basically. It's yeah. kind of just like a parallel to that, where, again, you know, a lot of these kids who probably got in this are going to grow up to make a lot more money than me at their jobs, because they're probably like one and done and in and out. And, so, you know, but outside of that, I still can't say why this one blew up, but, you know, it's good. Like, it has a groove to it. I don't mind it as much as I did back then, but it's still not really my shit. I can't explain to anybody why this is seminal, but, you know, it's probably one of the better of the genre, so I guess that's why it deserves to be good. But I probably appreciate it more now in hindsight than I did back then, but
yeah.
It's still not like an essential album to me.
I think the time this came out, I wouldn't have even given it a second glance. I wouldn't have listened to it. I wouldn't
yeah.
have, now, like, in the year since it's the fact that it's 2009, it's only 2018 now. So it's like, I was an adult, a grown yeah. adult that whole time, yeah. but I'm still kind of like shifting when it comes to dumb, heavy music. In the years before this, we were doing kind of a jokey, but serious heavy band.
Yeah.
You know, probably several years before this, I guess my calendar is all messed up in my brain. But we were in a band that had a sense of humor.
Actually, you know, it's not. I think our last show was like 2006, so it wasn't. And Trapped Under Ice was 2007. That's when their demo came out. So it wasn't that far apart.
It just made me really uptight. Back then, I was very uptight about like playing shows with goon bands or simple bands or whatever. And a few years of not being in any band related to that, like, lightened me up. And then I got into like slam metal, and then I got into more ignorant hardcore, and now I'm fine. Now I'm cured. I like it all. I don't give a shit. Like, even this album, like, this doesn't bother me. I'm not going to seek it out, but I hear what's good about it. I hear that it's like heavy, and that it pounds. I like that the vocals are energetic and popping. And I could tell that that's the thing people are ripping off. I know for a fact that his vocals are the thing that people are aping, and it's a very specific style. So when someone is doing the Trapped Under Ice vocal thing, you hear it. You hear it a mile away. You should probably be ashamed if you're actually you know, biting this dude's voice. But whatever, you know.
Yeah.
If I could sing like Lou Gramm from Foreigner, I certainly would.
I will say I'm glad this kind of led the way for now. A lot of these bands that were kind of in this circle are now just super heavy. Like Harm's Way is just like, or Jesus Piece, which is a little more metallic, but still I would kind of group them in where they're probably friends at some point or played like Torrid or whatever. And those bands are just fucking destructive. Well,
that's a thing that I didn't, I don't know the history, and I don't want to like become a total, I don't care about putting my foot in it a little bit, but I don't want to be a total fool. But I do think, That's why I said the Entombed thing and the Entombed Core thing, like that was all kind of related, because at some point something happened where studio wizardry and hardcore became normal, and being very, very, very heavy was cool again after a period of that not being cool at all. Like, you know, being a little bit more like fast hardcore, stripped down, messy street punk, whatever, DIY stuff kind of took over for a while. And then it went the other way, and all of a sudden you had to actually have, you know, the Pro Tools and the recording budget and the pedals and the amps to even be in the door. And now it's ridiculous. It's so heavy. Like, the stuff that's out there now is impossibly heavy compared to anything I listened to when I was a kid, whether people think it is or not. And I don't even think that's the thing that it kind of lets me down about some of these bands, is when I go to read the lyrics, they're just saying dumb shit. Like, they're in these like terrifyingly heavy, scary, wild, crazy bands that like blow my mind. And then the lyrics are just dumb. Like they're just singing about dumb stuff, like dumb everyday stuff. Like my jeans are too tight. You know, like, what the fuck, man? You know? I don't know. I also confused this band back then. I confused them relentlessly with the band Cold World. How far off was I? Because
that's the same ballpark, I think. Okay. Yeah.
And Cold World, in addition to everything else, and I don't know if Trapped on Ice is this way, Cold World was a merch band. They were a band, they were like one of the kind of early to the game, as far as I know, of putting out lots and lots of like streetwear and merch and, you know, cashing in on their audience a little bit. And, I don't care about that, but I'm also not all that excited about it. So that being a part of something that used to be like a, you know, there'd be an animal rights table at the show, and now all of a sudden it's just like, like three tables of Cold World t-shirts or whatever.
I've seen a lot of bands in modern times pull that off now. It's even like bands you've never heard of and no one's ever going to hear of, and they have like 28 designs, and it's smart. I mean, it's a good way to make money. Yeah.
Get money. So your album, Mike, you did.
The Melvins. Yeah. I did Melvins Houdini. This came out in 1993, I believe. Yes, September 21st, 1993.
It's amazing.
This is their Melvins major label debut, and it was on Atlantic Records. And I think a lot of people, if they knew my taste in music, they would be shocked that I'd never listened to the Melvins, but I never did. Yeah. I never listened to them because basically just the same excuse we use all the time, which was you have limited money.
Yep.
And limited research back when I was a kid. So I knew the Melvins. They were one of those bands that were on the borderline for me, where I knew it was either like alt rock or it was going to be cool. Yeah. I didn't know, because they were on a major label, and you know that's always a bad sign.
Yep.
And their graphics were kind of ambiguous. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't metal. It wasn't really super hardcore. It wasn't really super alt rock. They were kind of like in between everything. And I didn't know anybody who listened to the Melvins, so I just never took a chance on them. And after years passed and I kind of figure out what they were, I just never bothered. They have fucking 85 albums. I missed the boat. I'm going to move on. I kind of had a picture of what they sounded like. And honestly, I was pretty much completely correct on what I thought they sounded like. And that was kind of like heavier music, but not like we're going to try and be the heaviest band on earth. Just like heavier music that, you know, has like a little grunge twinge, because they're kind of pre-grunge. And a lot of people say they're Kurt Cobain's favorite band or whatever. And he's kind of the one that got them on Atlantic Records. And I've read their whole Wikipedia. So a lot of this, I know I sound like I know what I'm talking about, but you know, he was supposedly their producer, but the Wikipedia says he was basically passed out most of the time, and it was an actual nightmare to record this record. And this pretty much sounds exactly what I thought it would sound like. I was honestly kind of afraid that that basically this was like I was gonna just fall in love with this and just be like, oh my god, I can't believe I feel like such a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
I've been missing out on this whole time. I have to listen to these guys' 19 new records. But it wasn't like that. It was kind of just like, this is heavy. I like this. I do still feel like a dummy because they directly influenced two bands I really like a lot that I could just tell so easy. It's Carp, which is like, and Carp is so much to Melvins, and the Floor's, you know, popular period. Because Floor didn't start out sounding like they did on the self-titled and Beyond album, but that self-titled album is, you know, pretty much this album, but, you know, a little more melodic. And I liked it. I will say this might make me a cornball, but I thought my favorite song, and I would say if anything directly influenced Floor, I would just say it was this one track on here, which is Going Blind, which is a Kiss cover.
Yeah.
And man, that song sounds like Floor. It sounds like Floor heard that one Melvin song and said, we need to switch our band to start sounding like this.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, I'll let Scott get into it because I think he's more familiar, but I don't know how well that was received back then. But I think that was my favorite song on this. But yeah, it's the first six songs are just fucking amazing. They're great songs. You know, it's nothing where, like I said, where I'm just like, I fucking missed the boat. Like, I think if I heard this back then, they would have just settled into, for me, I don't know if everybody's like this, but for me, music is kind of like in two categories, or music I like at least is kind of in two categories. There's a lot of bands that I have like some kind of like personal connection to where I really like feel them and I want to, you know, read every lyric and see what they're up to and shit like that. And then there's bands that like I've always just kind of liked, and they were just kind of like they seemed like too hard to obtain. Like, yeah. For example, like Crowbar was like a band, you know, I've heard all their records up to a point. I've seen them a bunch of times, but they're just like never a band where I care to learn more about Crowbar, basically. Like, it was just like, you know, yeah, put on a fucking Crowbar record. That's great. Right. But I've never like learned the lyrics, and I don't know the names of the songs. And there was like a lot of like Helmet was another band back then. I was like that where I'm like, yeah, this is cool, but I don't really give a fuck about Helmet or what they're up to.
Yeah.
So that's how I would, like, I know for a fact if I heard Melvins back then, that's exactly how I would be. I wouldn't have become a Melvin super fan or anything like that. I would have known earlier that they influenced these bands that I love, but I don't think if I heard Melvins back then, it would have affected my love negatively or positively for Floor or anything like that. I would just be like, oh, Floor better than the Melvins. Yeah. And I probably, you know, I haven't heard their whole discography, but I still feel like that. I definitely like Floor better than this album. And I will say this album definitely suffers from that early to mid 90s all grunge rock wave of just having goofy shit on it. Because like after that sixth song, I would say Set Me Straight is the seventh song. That song's slightly goofy, and then Sky Pup is a completely goofy album, or goofy track. Joan of Arc is like the only pretty good song after that, and then it's just fucking garbage. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's great. I'm glad I finally listened to it. I'm sorry I don't have anything contentious to say about it. but, you know, I don't think, honestly, I do still feel like I kind of missed the boat in a way where I don't feel the need to listen to anything else. I don't think I'm gonna hear anything else Melvins that'll change my mind about them either way. So I'm glad I listened to it. I would have definitely loved it when I was 16. I was just a stupid kid with limited money and could not buy this record, and I had no friends that listened to it. I'm glad I finally listened to it, so if people bring them up in conversation, I can pretend I've listened to them since I was 16,
right,
even though I didn't. But yeah, great record. I could see why it influenced so many bands. It's definitely a type of heaviness that did not exist at the time. Mm-hmm. And I still think it's cool. Like, I still think bands like Carp and Floor are really cool, and I wish more bands did shit like that, but they're few and far between. But Scott, what do you think of the Melvins?
Melvins is interesting because the reason I wanted you to go second is that I think this is like a good example of how you can play guitar with one finger. You know, like, I don't know a ton about the Melvins. I'm a casual fan. I like them. If something with like King Buzzo or whatever is out there and he like gives an interview or something, I'll watch it because he's like a funny guy, and I've seen them live several times, and I think that what they're trying to do is not metal.
Hold the phone though. Yeah, you've seen them live. What kind of shows do the Melvins play? Because I don't know.
Okay, well, I've seen them. Most of the times I saw them was, did you know that the guy from Carp was in the Melvins?
You know, I didn't, I wasn't positive because I started watching that Carp documentary, and I thought they said something like that, but I couldn't remember if they were just friends or what, but I knew they had a connection. Yeah.
So I saw them once like a long time ago when they're in their normal format. I don't remember who was on bass, Joe Preston or somebody. You know, they've had a lot of bassists, but for a while they just absorbed the band Big Business.
Okay.
The Melvin took the whole band Big Business on tour with them, and then just took the band into being the Melvins. So the Melvins had two drummers, bassist, guitarist.
I remember that. That's why I always thought Melvins always had two drummers, but yeah, it makes sense because they don't have it on this one.
Right. And then I can't remember his name. He's got a name, whatever the singer of Carp's name is, who was in Big Business, is my
Jeff Carp.
Jeff Carp.
Yeah.
I think he has a name like Cody or something like that, or maybe that's like, but he's my favorite vocalist. Like, I love that guy's vocals a lot. Well, you know, probably next to like Freddie Mercury or something like that. But you know, like in terms of heavy music, he has one of my favorite voices. I love the cadences that he hits. I love that he kind of like forces it, that he hits notes hard and puts his whole body into shouting. And he sings with the Melvins on all the albums that he's on with them. They both basically sing like harmonies together. It's awesome. It is super awesome because they both have the same kind of delivery, kind of, you know, like that kind of burly shout sing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they were in the band, I saw them live a couple times that way, and they come out.
So they have records with both of these guys singing.
Yeah, there's like three. I think there might be three records, three full albums where.
I retract saying I'll probably go back and listen to these records then.
Yeah, but it's the same. It's kind of like you said, where I like the Melvins, but if I'm hearing the Melvins, I enjoy it, and if I'm not hearing the Melvins, I'm okay as well.
Yeah.
I always enjoy it. It's just an on or off switch. I hear it, I'm like, this is fucking awesome, man. Like, this is so good. But when I'm not hearing it, I don't necessarily crave it all that much. But I'm with you that when I was younger, because I'd been burned a lot by weird bands and wacky bands and kind of alt metal bands, you know, there was a whole label called Amphetamine Reptile.
Yeah.
Full of bands made to trick you.
Yes.
You know, they had goofy names and goofy visuals. It was like the Cows and Janitor Joe.
Jesus Lizard
was, you know, they turned out to be kind of an interesting Lubricated Goat. But there was, yeah, you know, all these bands where you could really spend your money hard and fast and get bullshit, or it could be awesome. And within the band, there could be a great album and a shit album, because there were just these experimental noise alt rock weirdos. And I thought the Melvins was in that same melee. I thought that whatever album I bought could be anything. And I think these days that is true, because they did some experimental stuff. But, for the most part, I just didn't really get into them until a little bit later. And then, you know, this Hooch off this album was the first Melvin song I ever heard. Pretty late. So I was pretty late to the game, kind of. It was on MTV. They made a video for that. And when I heard it, I was like, this is bullshit. I just didn't like it, because it's like heavy, but it never really leans into any of the grooves. It's like a weird song, and it kind of like stays on the offbeat and stays a little bit tense and never really resolves. And I just, you know, whatever. I was a teenager when this came out, and I just wasn't having that. I was like, I don't get this. This is stupid. This sounds like it should get to a slam part, and it never does. But, you know, when I started to say earlier was that, you know, you hear them now and you think of them as kind of like a sludge metal or like a proto something band. And I don't think they're ever trying to do that. I think that they were just trying to be a rock band.
Yeah.
But like a limited inventory rock band. Like when you play Mega Man, you can only take the saw blade in and you got to beat the boss with the saw blade. That's what they were doing. They're saying, okay, well, I got this one guitar that is run through like a Sun Beta lead head. And then I have a drummer who plays with baseball bats, and that's what we have to work with. So I want to play stuff that sounds like Queen and Kiss, but all I have is, you know, saltwater taffy and sticks. And that's what they do. And I think that song Going Blind that you pointed out is a hat tip. That's like, if you had been listening to the whole album the whole way through and you were thinking it was supposed to be avant-garde metal, they give you the nod. They say, hey, listen to this song. We're just playing sleazy rock.
Yeah.
All we're doing is we're just trying to play like sleazy 70s rock, but put through this weird Play-Doh fun factory of what we do. And I believe that that's the intent. I don't think that that's like the side effect. It's like if you were like, I want to be in a Carcass cover band, but I only know how to play banjo. Whatever you do with that is going to be your own thing. Even though you're covering a band or trying to ape a band, you're going to come up with your own sound. And I think that that's kind of what the Melvins ended up with. And the people after that don't do that. The people after that want to sound like the Melvins. They want to be like heavy band. Maybe Carp. Probably. I think Floor is a good example of where they don't really get it, because Torch sucks.
Yeah, Torch sucks. Yeah.
Torch after the first album, if the first album is basically still Floor, but then they keep going and I think they lose the program. I don't really like it. So I'm a fan of the Melvins. I like them. I'm a heretic in that I like them a little bit better with the Big Business stuff. I've never bothered to listen to the stuff when they got really Ipecac Records-y, when King Buzzo was in Fantomas and they were doing the Fantomas big band with the Melvins. And there's all this, you know, there's all that mid-period stuff that I think there's some noise albums they put out and some experiment. I'm not going to listen to that. I'm not even going to put it's free now. It's free and I'm not going to play it. But I'm always happy to hear this. Like, I'm always happy to hear these rock songs. I think that this album is probably one of my favorites, and it probably shouldn't be, because this is their, you know, their major label flop or whatever. But it's really satisfying. Like like you said, the first 6-7 songs of this album are very satisfying, super melodic, super heavy. And then when they get to Going Blind, that's like a super, super satisfying, like proto sludge metal song. You don't really need anything else. So yeah, I'm like a fan of this, and I wasn't back then. It's kind of more in adulthood that I came around to it, even though a lot of my friends were into it at the time.
So did you have friends that listened to them when you were a teen?
Yeah, when I was a little bit like an older teen, like my friend Tom from.
So were they metal acceptable with like the Hessian kids?
I don't think it would ever come up. I think if you would listen to the Melvins, you were probably like a punk or alt rock dude.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that they sidled in and or you were someone who was into Nirvana and you had, you know, backfilled the Melvins. Like a lot of people, you know, not by 93, yeah. Nirvana had already broken. That's the reason this came out, I think, is because Nirvana name dropped them and got them, you know, got them some juice. They were. Weren't they on their second big album by this time? I don't know. I think like Heart Shaped Box and stuff was out by this time.
So
they were like the full fledged, like the final version of Nirvana by this time.
Yeah, this was just when record labels were signing like anybody remotely related to that scene. So
I'm curious how bad it flopped, because this flopped, right? Like this was the major label debut and it didn't go well.
They hated recording it, all this shit. Yeah.
I don't know. He does like spoken word stuff, Buzzo, like with his guitar on and with his like monk robes I don't know if he does it still, but you can watch YouTubes of him just doing these kind of like TED talks about being, you know, more or less like a loser grunge guy or what, you know, like a loser of the grunge wars. And, he's a funny guy and he's interesting and they're very plain spoken and they're very, but something like, I think you tapped into it a little bit. Here's what sucks about the Melvins. The lyrics are awful, like awful, awful, like poop, scoop, poop, diddy, whoop, scoop, awful. Like they're just stupid. They're not, there's not, I mean, he says that there's meaning to them. I was like, I got to find out. And I did some reading and he says that every song has meaning. Bullshit. Like these are just made up words and like nursery rhyme sounds and space filler. And it's like, they're a band who doesn't want to commit to, you know, a statement or something like that. And I've played in bands with people, not Mike, of course, my favorite, but I've played in bands where the singer is satisfied with whatever words he just came up with and will just use this. He'll use like the placeholder as the final version. I have really, really limited respect for that. I remember being like a young person who thought it would be super funny to just, you know, sing nursery rhymes over a death metal song or whatever. And then I turned 15 years old and I moved past it. And this guy, he's still going. Like you go open up Dark Lyrics, go to Dark Lyrics and go to the M's and look up the Melvins. All the way from the 80s to now, he's still just writing these like poop scoop lyrics. And they're shocking. And, you know, it's like, I guess if you don't have anything to say, that's cool. But I don't know, write a story, hire a ghostwriter, write some stuff that's in kind of English. Cause when I actually read these lyrics, I want to sing along with some of these songs. Some of them are really anthemic. I'm not going to sing your fucking words, man. I'm not going to do it. So my second album, maybe, I don't know if it'll be a surprise to anybody, but it's Suede by the band Suede, also known as the London Suede, probably because I'm assuming a lawsuit. this is, I don't know if it's their first album, but it's their self-titled album. It's the big one. It came out in 1993 on Nude Records. That's super sexy. And it keeps going from there because you look at that cover and man, it is sexy. It's two people.
Ambiguous
kissing.
People. Yeah, two ambiguous people. Who knows kissing. What they are?
Yeah.
There's no such thing as gender anymore, guys. And Suede knew it back in 1993.
That's part of the story, actually, you know, to be honest. So they were part of the Britpop movement, which was, you know, I didn't realize the word Britpop mainly referred to this 90s shit. I thought it was an older word. But in the 90s, Oasis, Blur, Pulp, I guess like Supergrass, The Verve, like just a bunch of bands came over. None of them sound alike. None of them have anything to do with each other other than they're British. And they're very British. Like that was the key, is that they were extremely British and like happy to be British. And, you know, they dressed British and they ate British and they look British. And these guys were in that. And, you know, Oasis is the big one. If you're 24 to 34 years old right now, last year you were posting Wonderwall memes. And this year you are for some reason listening to Oasis sincerely. Like it, you know, just like Smash Mouth. People were making that joke too long and then it stuck. They started actually listening to Smash Mouth again. And this year I could see on Twitter, and I don't even get out that much, but I see that people are like, well, you know, I actually, like, I've started, like, unironically listening to Oasis again. Well, fuck you, man. Oasis.
I just want to go on the record. I've always liked Oasis. So.
Fuck that. Fuck. There may be more to Oasis. For me, Oasis is Wonderwall, and that song is nails on a chalkboard. 10 minutes of him going, Wanda, you can't come back from that. But one of the Oasis dudes sings on a Chemical Brothers song called Setting Sun. That song is a banger. It's one of those kind of like big beat, you know, Prodigy, whatever songs. It's awesome. His vocals on it make it. So, like, you know, there's gold in those teeth somewhere, but I'm not an Oasis fan, and when I hear them, they make my skin crawl. But they're the big one. So, you know, if Oasis is Guns N' Roses, Blur is like Metallica, and Suede is basically Slayer. Like, they're a little less popular, a little harder to get into. Probably don't even care. I don't know. Like, I don't really know much about the band, but they don't seem like the kind of guys who are very excited by fame and fortune. But yeah, so this band hit while, you know, at the same year as that Melvins album, and the same era where I had gone through Nirvana already, but I was still into Ministry and all kinds of other weird stuff, and I wanted to hear more weird stuff. I was trying to de-metal on purpose. I was like intentionally trying to de-metal. So I'd watch 120 minutes every night, or Postmodern MTV or Alt Nation or whatever it was. And, you know, you'd sit through the Smashing Pumpkins video and the Shaman, and, you know, you'd hope for like one Add End to X video or something like that. And they had a song that actually hit that year. And, you know, so first of all, remember that I was an angry fat metal teen with very traditionally angry fat metal teen values. So with that in mind, cue up the video for Metal Mickey and see if you can, you know, just think of me and think of how I was interpreting the video. But the video has an ambiguous character, like a gender ambiguous character, walking through the streets dressed like some sort of Victorian dandy, but in like a bodysuit. It's like a bodysuit it's almost like, what do you call those suits? Those Zentai suits or whatever that are like, you know, like the Green Man from It's Always Sunny.
Oh, you know,
the leotards that people wear as a joke now to sporting events.
Unitard.
This person has like a unitard that is colored like a dandy outfit with a big floppy hat and a mustache. But the person could be male or female, and it's very, you know, slender and effeminate looking, and they're just walking through the streets. And then the band themselves are not particularly rugged looking. So I had a trouble, and the song's called Metal Mickey, but it's not a metal song. So I had a lot of problems with this when I was a teenager. Not now. Like, I'm just, you know, for the record, I'm a pretty progressive person these days. But at the time this record came out, I was I had a different way. So I think that this singer heard the song Gangsters or Nightclub by the Specials when he was a kid and was like, I want to do that for the rest of my life. He sounds exactly like Terry Hall from The Specials, only doing some sort of voice cracking thing relentlessly, almost to the point where, like, I don't know if you could fake this. I don't know if this couldn't be a bit. Like, he may actually have like the DMC from Run DMC strained vocal cords, you know?
He had a heart attack from drugs.
Yeah. like every syllable this guy says, his voice is cracking, and it's like part of his style. And, you know, it's pretty idiosyncratic. It's like his own thing. And I don't know, like, we'll get to how you feel about this. I got used to it. Like, I was like, you know, it kind of almost sounds like someone doing pinch harmonics on a guitar. He's got a technique that he does with his vocals, and I don't really mind it that much after a while. But the thing about this album is that I think this, you can hear what you want to hear in this. So if you come to this album thinking it's going to be boring, like smeary, bland rock, you'll hear that. If you come to it looking for like Radiohead, you'll hear that. If you come to it looking for, you know, whatever, like, I think you can, it's kind of, it's got a weird sound where you can find what you want in it. And, you know, the drums and the bass are really well, like regular rock and roll production. Like, they're just really well produced. And then the guitars, the vocals, and the cymbals are all kind of fighting for the exact same frequencies. Like, they're all kind of like a hiss or like a swish or something that's like, it presses on your ear like someone blowing into your ear. And I kind of like that. Like, that sounds bad, but it's like the way that the vocals are struggling to be heard. Like, that's why I used to like the screamo stuff when I was a kid, because it sounds like the vocalist is like drowning. And I think that that's what this album is like. The vocalist almost sounds like he's drowning in all these, like, you know, shoegazy distorted guitars that are playing kind of weird notes. Like, they're just playing rock music, but they're picking odd notes. And I like that kind of stuff. So I didn't like it when I was a kid, and I don't like it when they try and play normal rock on this album. There's a few songs where they try to be like, and that singer tries to keep up with that beat and he can't do it. Like that, that like cricket chirping thing that he's doing with his voice doesn't land on anything other than the really, melodramatic. That's what this, to me, what this sounds like is if a bunch of like snakes and vampires wanted to cover Roy Orbison or like Torch songs. You know, it sounds alien, it sounds bloodless and pale, but it sounds like they're trying to be really melodramatic pop like Roy Orbison or something like that, using like whatever ghostly spectral power is left in their weird bodies. That's kind of how this sounds to me. So I ended up liking it more than I thought. Like, I actually like this quite a bit. Like, not the whole album, and it falls apart toward the end. It just becomes kind of like normal rock, and the more you get to be just normal guitar rock, the less I'm interested. But what did you think of it, Mike?
So I'm pretty open to this stuff. I have never heard of Suede in my life. Yeah. I'm sure somebody said it, and I just never fucking paid attention. When Scott said he's doing Suede, I just assumed there's some old soul band, but it's some Britpop band.
Yeah.
And, so I knew nothing about this fucking band going into this. And, like I said, I was open to it, and I listened, and there was the first listen. I was like, there's something. It wasn't the vocals. And I was just like, there's something I really don't like about this, and I don't know what it is. And the second listen, I caught it on. And it's what Scott said is the production on the guitars and basically everything that's not the drums. And it's just like, it's such a weird production. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Wikipedia because I was like, I want to see if I'm justified for thinking this. And there is a whole entry on the production of this record. And how the it's some fucking, you know, British producing guy, like he's a known guy. And it's like, it explains his methods that he, his method of producing is, basically latching on and forming a close friendship with, the person in the band he thinks is the most important, which is, the guitarist. He thought the guitarist was the most important person in the band. And that just seems very odd to me, because it's fine when they're doing like the, you know, the fucking, the trippy kind of,
yeah,
all over the place swirling guitars. But yeah, when they hit the rock stuff, it's just so limp, and it's just like, I don't know, man. Like, I'm used to, you know, like Scott said, Britpop doesn't really mean anything. It's not a certain framework for music, but
right.
I'm used to it being pretty guitar centric. So I was just kind of like, when I found out it was Britpop, I was kind of expecting that, and it's not. It's just kind of limp in that category. And and I was fine when I was like, this is not for me. I could see why people would like this. But then, since I was on their Wikipedia, I read their whole backstory, and it made me absolutely hate this. I guess Scott didn't read it. But basically, the story behind this band is, before they even had an album, like before they even had recorded music out, they were on the cover of the you know, NME, the biggest British rock magazine, being proposed as the next big band of Britain, basically. Like, they were just like, they inherited it, like, you guys are gonna save British rock music. Wow. And this is before they even had a record on, and it was just like even the Freddie Mercury movie that just came out, it was just like a movie kind of scenario where, you know, they played like one show and everybody tried to sign them, and you know, they got like the best product, like they got the best recording studio and all this stuff, because they're gonna be the saviors of Britain. And it worked, you know. I guess they were popular for a while, and I can't fucking believe that, man. Out of all the bands that were from that scene, that this one is the one I definitely like the least.
Yeah.
And I just don't get it. I don't understand how they were coronated with all this stuff, and it worked on people, where they just bought this record hand over fist, and it was really popular and really big, because it's like, it's not, I don't think it's as good as Oasis or any of those bands, Blur, or any of those bands at all. So I'm, don't mind that I never heard of Suede before. I don't completely hate this. Yeah. I think if it had different production, and it sucks because after I listened to it a few times, not that I'm this thorough or I care this much about this podcast, but the version on Spotify has like all of their demo versions, and right. I probably should have listened to those to see how different they were, but I didn't bother. But yeah, I think the production really kills this for me of any hope of liking this. And I honestly think I'd be very curious to find somebody that would listen to this the first time in 2018 and like it.
Yeah.
Cause I don't see it. I don't see anybody hearing this record for the first time now and liking it. So I feel fine with not really liking it.
Thanks, Mike. You ruined it for me. I thought I was a fan and now I'm not. Like, all holes are unfilled.
Yeah.
So I that doesn't surprise. Like, to me, because I don't know much about it, and because, you know, like, if you ever read a British magazine, boy, do they like blow the artists pages. Like, they really make a big deal. Yeah, at least the ones that you get over here in Borders or Barnes & Noble or whatever, that were like, you know, $17 for the magazine or whatever. So it kind of stands to reason that if an artist made it over here at all, they had probably had their balls thoroughly washed before they ever made it. So I guess that makes sense. I didn't really, the way that they present from the video and from the album or whatever sounds more like anarchic and dark to me, but finding out that they were the golden boys of Britpop, does that suck. So fuck this band.
I mean, it sucks. That's why I try not to read this stuff, because I like to listen to this stuff. And trust me, when we get to Captain Beefheart next, that's all I did was hear about this band because I had to. But it's just going into it knowing that was just kind of made it shitty for me. But
yeah,
like I said, I don't know. I don't see the connection with this band.
Well, I didn't like it. I heard it when I was a kid and I didn't like it. I don't think I would have. I think that there was an era, like whenever OK Computer came out, I didn't like it. But later on, I heard whatever, like the first big guitar song on OK Computer, and that riff is really cool. And that kind of changed me and kind of like opened me up to this stuff. So I don't know if I would like this after that or not, but it had to be pretty, like, this kind of music had to be really something to catch me when I was young. It had to be really odd or really good or really,
I will say, there's definitely a couple songs. I think it has the word pop in it. And so I think anything with pop in it should have memorable songs after the first time you listen to them.
Right.
And I don't think it really has that. Although that Animal Nitrate song is good. And there's a song I like where he says, like, you're something sign, I'm an air sign. And it sounds like he's saying, I'm an asshole. And I'm just like, that's pretty cool. He's calling himself an asshole, but he's not really saying that.
That'd be a good one. Basically, all the way up to the song. I think all the way up to the song, maybe The Drowners. There's like a really like laid back, gentle ballad. I don't fuck with that. Like, if you do a laid back, like, I don't like any rock. I don't like when the Rolling Stones do like a laid back piano. I love Queen. When they do a song where it's just like a piano and singing, I don't like that. I don't want to hear that stuff. It just doesn't really work for me. So this band, they have one of those songs that gets really soft and laid back and just has plinky guitar and maybe a piano or something. That shit could take a hike.
Okay, then I'm going to wrap this up with a record called Trout Mask Replica by the band, or maybe just the man, Captain Beefheart. This is from 1969. This is a second episode in a row where I do a record from 1969, and I think this might be the end of it for me. I think
we're gonna leave 69 behind forever. Yeah,
I'm done exploring the year 1969. I chose this record because I never heard anything about it. I chose this record because I think I said on an earlier episode that I just want to go through all of the 33 and a third books records that seemed like somewhat interesting to me. And this was one of the first books they came out. I mean, this might have been honestly in the first five, and it pissed me off because 33 and a third has been around forever. It's been around for like 15 years or something now, at least. And in the early days, it was just like a lot of books about rock albums I don't give a shit about. And there was one about DJ Shadow, and there's one about the Beastie Boys, and I think maybe the Joy Division was, I think that might have been out by then. Yeah. Was there even a Joy Division one? I could be making that up. There's a Morrissey one, I know that, or a Smiths one, but either way. So I'd always look for, because this is still a little before it was common to just buy stuff off Amazon. So I'd always go to the bookstore and look for it. And I'd always see this fucking one, this Trout Mask Replica one, and be like, you motherfucker, I don't know what this is. I think I like that cover. It's weird. That's a weird cover. probably not gonna like the music. So I just, you know, never bothered, but it's always stuck in my head. If you guys have never seen the cover, it's basically like a man with a trout face.
Yep.
And it's in that real like contrast heavy early 70s style of just like horrible photography basically, and yep. It's very striking. It's a very striking cover.
It's like bright reddish pink or something like that, so it's certainly eye-catching.
Yeah. And so you know, I'm coming off of King Crimson here that I kind of enjoyed, so I was like, hey, maybe Captain Beefheart's pretty good. I was completely wrong. This is fucking, so this record is also an hour and 20 minutes long. Yeah, it's an hour and 20 minutes long.
Yeah, it's two records.
It's two records, a double album. So it starts off, if you guys don't know the deal like me of Captain Beefheart, it's just basically fucking nonsense music. It's exactly what you think of, like hippie 1969 exploring our minds bullshit music that's unlistenable, completely unlistenable bullshit music. And so it starts off exactly like that, with unlistenable bullshit music. I like this guy's voice. He has a really good voice.
Yeah.
I wish he applied it to better music. But so it starts off with that, and I'm like, okay, King Crimson started off rough too, so maybe this stops with fucking nonsense. But it doesn't. It goes on for two whole hours. It's as I found out through research, this is normal. You're not supposed to be able to sit down and listen to this record in one sitting. And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with people doing bullshit like that. But what pissed me off is seeing in their, first thing in their Wikipedia, this is number 60, which is pretty high on Rolling Stone's 500 greatest albums of all time.
Yeah.
So this isn't not only an essential album. This is like a highly touted essential album. Like this is up there. This is, you know, this is fucking up there. This is not like the fucking Melvins, man. Melvins probably like the 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 most essential album, but this is number 60. This is fucking high up there. And I'm just like, this is fucking bullshit. So, strike one again, just like King Crimson, not on Spotify. So luckily, luckily they're on YouTube though. So I listen to this on YouTube. And as you guys know, if you listen to stuff on YouTube, they give you recommends in your sidebar. So, one of my recommends one day was for, I forget the name of it, but it's like a 10 minute, I guess you would kind of call it mini documentary, basically titled something like, this is why the Captain Beefheart record is actually good. It's basically like something like that. And it's basically 10 minutes of somebody explaining to you why you should like this record.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of makes sense in a way for 1969, because basically the whole spiel is that, this Captain Beefheart man was like this eccentric weirdo, and he started this band, and he wanted these guys, these musicians, to play this music that was basically impossible to play on guitar and bass. Mm-hmm. And he's using like a piano, I guess, as like reference. So he wants them to play these chords that don't exist on a guitar. And so basically it's a 10-minute thing explaining to you why this is actually like really intricate what they're doing. And basically they practiced for 2 years playing this fucking album front to back so they could record it in just like a couple takes, which is very admirable, because this is not music, because it sounds like nonsense. So it's not music you hear and think, oh, they put a lot of thought into this. This honestly sounds like people just fucking dicking around. It sounds like me dicking around because it's fucking bullshit music. But I guess if you're a fucking weird guitar nerd or like just a weird music composition nerd in real life, this makes sense to you in a way where you're just like, oh, I understand what they're doing. However, I don't care about that. Yeah. This is bullshit. This is like, you can't have this long of a narrative or this long of a context and say, oh, this is still good because this, like, maybe in 1969 you could, but you could say the same thing about one of my favorite albums of all time is DJ Shadow's Introducing. Yep. And it's an album you could listen to and you'd be like, that's fine. Or maybe you'd say, I hate it. And the whole context of that is he made this album completely from just snippets of other albums, which is mind-blowing for when it came out. Now it's probably a lot easier, but then it was, and it's not like, you know, it's not like fucking Girl Talk where he's just using like the top 40 pop songs. This guy is digging deep into records that no one knows about. Mm-hmm. And he's making these insane compositions out of them. And but it's listenable. You can't listen to King Crimson like that. Even if you hate DJ Shadow and you hate all the songs, it's still a listenable thing you could play on the radio.
Right.
And people would say, oh, okay, I don't like that. But it's not this. It's not fucking grating and abrasive and horrible and shitty shit. So, I mean, I absolutely hated this. This is fucking awful. No one ever needs to listen to this. I think we've hit a point. It's 2018. You should retract this top 60 albums. Like I said, even like DJ Kubert's Wave Twisters. It's, you know, it's a guy just playing the fucking turntables.
Yeah.
And that's pretty crazy. Who knew you could do that? Who knew you can make an entire album just dicking around on a turntable? No one's calling that the 60th best fucking album of all time. So I don't understand why Captain Beefheart's the 60th best album of all time. Maybe in 1971 it was, because there was only, you know, 3,000 albums by that point. But, you know, it's 2018. There's millions of albums. This is fucking bullshit. I want this retracted. I know there, I think there's already been a couple people that have said they were fans of this album and they were waiting for this when I said we're going to do this next. So I don't know what the fuck you see in this. I get the context and it's a cool story and maybe make a fucking movie about it. But I don't fuck this. This is fucking terrible. This is, I don't think I will ever hear anything on the show worse than this.
we could probably beat this.
I don't know. This is like Kissing Con on Kissing Con. This, I had Dr. Zhivago is regarded as this classic film, and that movie fucking sucks. this is like the music version of Dr. Zhivago for me, where you can't convince me this is fucking good. This is awful, awful shit. I would have absolutely hated this when I was 16. There's no doubt about it. I hate it at any age. But Scott, were you familiar, or do you feel these music nerd feelings because you actually play instruments about Captain Beefheart?
No, I don't like Captain. I don't like this. I mean, like I've known about it. I've listened to it. I've tried. It's one of those things I try on and off because I know it's, you know, something I should like. I don't like Frank Zappa. I don't like Captain Beefheart. And honestly, you know, like so the first song on this album basically sounds like dicking around free jazz.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went through a whole jazz phase and I still like jazz and I liked some free stuff, but, and I'm not saying people are wrong. That just like chaos. Like if you like listening to chaos, it like really turns you on. That's okay. Like there's some place to go with that. When I hear like music that is, you know, quote unquote free, but is more like, you know, group improvisation, I expect like any member can tug the song in any way. That's like what I think of as free jazz, is that like if a guy has an idea, he can take the song that way, but that the other guys will kind of follow him for a while at least. And then one of them can take over, you know, like, so everybody can like push and pull the song however they want and come up with new ideas and change the song. To me, that's like a cool thing about free jazz, or that it's like a really crazy outpouring, like some Albert Ayler, like just basically screaming, you know, like scream therapy or something like that. Like they're just going nuts on their instruments. That's another kind of like free jazz. But I don't really like, I've never been able to just listen to the chaos version, just the dicking around version. And even on this album, I don't know if it's Dachau Blues, it's one of these songs. There's a few parts on this album where you can hear that one guitar will start going like, and then you hear the bass go, and then you hear another guitar going, guess what's happening there? Like they're each trying to hear themselves. You know, like everybody's making so much fucking noise that each member of the band is trying to just do something on his instrument that he can actually hear above it, like so that they can feel good about. I can't even hear what's going on. I'm just going to go up the neck on my bass and then I'll at least be able to hear something. So the whole thing is basically a disagreement. Like this whole album is just a bunch of people disagreeing about like what song they're playing to me.
See, that's what this documentary explains, where this is, I don't know. It explains how it sounds like that, but it's really not, man. You got to really listen.
I guess possibly, you know, I'm not going to say no to that. Like, I'm not going to say that maybe this guy is that eccentric and what he likes is something that sounds like, you know, the cliche of drums falling down the stairs. I don't think this
sounds like real bad. Like they had like real stuffy college professors in this documentary too, just being like, yeah, it's true, this is all true.
There's definitely parts of this. So there's stuff on this. So there's I'll take a little detour. One of my favorite albums when I was like a jazz dude is Mingus Epitaph. It's this big crazy double album. Mingus was already dead, but like his boys or whatever put together like his final message. And it's really dense. It's really like awesome. It's exciting. It's epic. It's a big band playing this almost like neoclassical noise jazz ambitious thing. And it has some cover songs in it. It has everything. It's a little bit of everything. It's just like, it's almost like a cinematic version of, you know, avant-garde jazz done by like 30 dudes. It's awesome. It's like super epic. And there's songs in it where It sounds like swing, like do 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 do. You know, it's like just swing jazz, but they're playing all weird notes. So the melody will keep wandering and getting crazy and dissonant, but it still stays in the structure. Like it still keeps swinging and it still keeps doing it, and they're all playing together, but they're choosing dissonance and like ambiguity in the song. I like that a lot. I like when the wagon is on fire, but the horses are still running.
Yeah.
You know, like that to me is awesome. And on this album, they do that sometimes too. There's definitely some songs on here. Like, I don't, there's a song called Pachuco Cadaver. There's a few songs where they're doing almost like this mountain blues, but a weird version of it. And they're all playing together, but they're dismantling the song. And that to me, like the sort of structured version of fucking with something is pretty cool. But just the stuff where it's just like, sounds like everybody's tuning. It sounds like before practice.
Yeah.
When everyone's like, I haven't seen my amp in 2 weeks. I'm so excited to like put my drums together for the first time in a month. I'm just going to like, we're all going to make noise. We're all going to do something. And then this guy. So here's another problem I have. I'm pretty sure. So like you listen to this guy, they take moments out of the music to let this guy just do little recitations and to say quotes. And he's just like, the squid pushed the cheese through the mailman's tushy and he had a hair pie. And I know that there was like beat poetry and dissociative verse. There's like, this can't have been groundbreaking. This is so silly that there's no way that by this time, just doing this like free form, wild, like fantasy thinking, you know, free associative writing like this.
Yeah.
No way is this groundbreaking at this time. I didn't
mention that, but yeah, basically that was one of my descriptions. It was just like the stereotypical thing of when people make fun of like beat poets, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just that.
Yeah. And, you know, you can get it just by reading down the song titles. The song titles actually sound like I'm making fun of a bunch of guys in a hippie van. Yeah. You know, it just sounds like it's all nonsense. I'd seen, just like, I don't know when I was younger and Comedy Central was just mainlining the Saturday Night Live episodes. Yeah. They were just like showing them relentlessly, and they played the one with Captain Beefheart. And that, back then I liked it because they were doing like Ashtray Heart, which is one of his, I don't think it's on this album. It's on another song. And you know, the phrase Ashtray Heart, that sounds cool. You know, that to me, that sounds like there could be meaning to that. And there was all these guys going wild while this guy was doing this like Wolfman Jack grunting in front. If you hear it in that presentation, like I bet if you saw this and it was just this sort of like wild thing going on or whatever, it could probably be pretty convincing, but I don't know. I'm very curious. And I know that this guy got around and got into some other things and did some other stuff, and that he's like one of Zappa's guys, and Zappa's involved in this album. Zappa's full of shit too. So
yeah.
Yeah. I don't really like any, I don't like poopy joke music. I don't like, dicking around on instruments, and I don't really like the sound of the 70s and the 60s in this capacity, you know, like shitty, cheap old amps and fooling around on your shitty, cheap old amps. So, when you were a young man, were you, jazzy enough that you would have tried to pretend to like this?
No, man, I don't even like when Iceburn got too weird. And, you know, you were required to like Iceburn back then, basically.
Yes.
And, you know, I only liked Fyron, which was like Pyron, which was like their normal record.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure fucking Iceburn loved this record, but no, there's no way.
I wonder if Captain Beefheart has a Fyron in his catalog. Like if
well, yeah, like you said, I don't think it was the same song you said, but I looked for live videos just to see what it would be like. And it was from some show, and it was some later song, and did, you know, it sounded like you said, a little more controlled mm-hmm. chaos, which is fine. I'm that's what I was hoping for, and that is not at all what this is. This is fucking nonsense, and there's no amount of documentaries that's gonna prove me wrong about thinking this is nonsense.
So, did you listen to the entire album front to back multiple times, or did you just spend
No.
Did you even make it to the full album?
The first day I listened to the 20 minutes. And I took a day off, and then I fucking powered through the rest of it. I don't know how I did it, but it was tough. Like, it was just, I couldn't even, it was the same thing I do with movies, where if it's really, really bad, I can't look at the minutes or I'm going to fucking freak out. So I just had it in a different tab on YouTube, and I just let it play. And when it was over, I was so happy that it finally ended. And I'm fucking very proud of myself that I even got it through it in two sittings.
Well, I have a pretty thick skin for like, you know, experimental, weird, dumb free shit. But even I look down and, you know, on your phone, the scrub bar goes away. And when I tapped and it was only halfway through, I was like, and, you know, one of the things that's happened since I've watched this album is now I get nothing but these simulated live ads on my phone. For, you know, like sign up for my webinar and I could teach you how to make, you know, up to $10,000 a day doing a drop shipping thing or whatever. Like I get these, all of these different ads that tell me how I could be a drop shipper or how I can be an affiliate marketer or how I can be a print on demand t-shirt specialist. So, I mean, the upside is that I'm going to make a lot of money after from this album. No joy, no worms, no boat.